Picture a Harvard professor standing at the threshold of a monastery, her world shattered by losses so devastating they defy comprehension. Within 18 months, she's buried both her 6-year-old son and her physicist husband. She arrives not seeking faith, but survival, some way to metabolize grief that threatens to consume her entirely. This is where Elaine Pagels found herself, and where her exploration of humanity's oldest question begins. Why does religion persist, even for those who've studied its contradictions and construction for decades? We often imagine religious scholars as detached analysts, dissecting ancient texts with clinical precision. But what happens when the woman who spent her career translating secret gospels and deconstructing theological systems suddenly needs those very traditions to survive? This paradox drives one of the most honest explorations of faith's purpose ever written, not as abstract philosophy, but as urgent, visceral necessity. Growing up in 1950s Palo Alto meant living in what Pagels describes as a giant marshmallow of suburban conformity. Her scientist father dismissed religion as primitive superstition, yet his atheism coexisted with terrifying rages. Her mother offered no refuge, responding to childhood confidences with dismissive rejections. At 15, she answered Billy Graham's altar call, not from naivety, but rebellion. Evangelical Christianity opened vast spaces of imagination her emotionally arid home couldn't provide. She discovered something crucial. Religion offered access to dimensions of human experience that scientific materialism couldn't touch. When her artistic friend Paul's father threatened psychiatric commitment, Elaine volunteered at Camarillo State Mental Hospital. There, she met patients like Maria, who'd gained weight deliberately to ward off sexual assaults, and 6-year-old Samantha, who clung desperately during story time. These encounters revealed how institutions often amplified helplessness rather than healing it. After Paul's death in a car accident, her questions intensified. Why hadn't religion disappeared as her father predicted? How did a story about a tortured rabbi become a worldwide movement still spreading 2 millennia later? Harvard's religion department rejected her application. Women students always quit before completing the degree. Her father agreed, calling graduate school crazy for a woman. She should become a secretary instead. She persisted, completing a master's at Stanford with support from her Dutch grandparents. At Harvard, she found both intellectual exhilaration and predatory danger. 4 weeks after arriving, a German divinity professor who'd had her babysit his children trapped her overnight in attempted sexual assault. He became her advisor and continued his behavior. Years later, she learned therapists at Harvard Health Services privately called him Kuster the Molester. Yet the intellectual discoveries proved transformative. Her naive hope to find Christianity's essence shattered when professors revealed file cabinets of secret gospels Thomas, Philip, Mary Magdalene discovered in 1945 near Nag Hammadi, Egypt. For the first time, heretics could speak through their own texts. These alternative gospels contained abundant feminine imagery for God that her male colleagues had overlooked. In the secret revelation of John, divine figures appeared as father, mother, and son. Other texts reimagined Eve not as Adam's tempter, but as his spiritual teacher, a radical inversion challenging Orthodox Christianity. When Pagels announced her engagement to physicist Heinz Pagels, her advisor exploded. Harvard had wasted 4 years on her education, a reaction never directed at male students. After 7 years of infertility, their son Mark arrived in 1983 with a heart defect that would have been fatal just years earlier, but new surgical techniques offered hope. The night before Mark's surgery, Pagels experienced something that defied her scholarly skepticism. Praying in their darkened apartment, she sensed a menacing presence and forcefully invoked Christ's name until it dissipated. The operation succeeded, though seeing their tiny son buried beneath IV lines proved devastating. When Mark recognized her voice and lurched toward her, accidentally dislodging needles, a nurse harshly reprimanded her, triggering crushing maternal guilt. A MacArthur Genius Grant arrived with divine timing, providing 5 years of financial support. They hired Jean da Silva, a compassionate nanny who became essential. Then a routine cardiac catheterization stretched to 9 excruciating hours. Doctors emerged with devastating news. Mark had developed pulmonary hypertension, a rare fatal condition with no cure. When the medical team pressed for a lung biopsy to study the disease, Pagels refused, recognizing it would advance research but offer Mark nothing. Mark returned to normal life school. Friends, karate, cartoons. Standing on a redwood stump in a karate pose, he declared, "I came here to fight," understanding, Pages felt, that he was fighting death itself. After a miscarriage, they began adopting a premature baby girl in Texas. During the 2-month wait, Mark dreamed they would leave him in the cemetery they passed daily, revealing his awareness of the vulnerability adults tried to hide. When they brought their daughter home, the social worker asked her name, Sarah. Hines and Elaine exchanged amazed looks. Over a year earlier, Mark had mysteriously told Elaine, "I'm the king of dragons, and the queen of dragons is named Sarah." One April evening, Mark clung to his mother. "I'll love you all my life and all my death." The next day, during a routine blood test, he stiffened and his eyes rolled up. When Pages fell unconscious, she seemed to enter a brilliant green place with golden light. After reviving, she and Hines spoke to Mark, feeling his presence near the ceiling. His heart briefly restarted, but soon stopped. He was 6 years old. Though many couples separate after losing a child, Hines and Elaine drew closer, united in grief. They felt devastated, yet relieved. The sword hanging over their lives had fallen. 2 months later, friends invited them to a dinner dance. Though hesitant, they went, finding unexpected comfort as other dancers protectively surrounded them. After Mark's death, Pagels created rituals at places he'd loved. In Colorado, they settled into normalcy with 13-month-old Sarah. Pagels found solace in practices learned from Cistercian monks at St. Benedict's Monastery. Father Thomas Keating taught meditation and contemplative prayer that calmed emotional turbulence. Unlike others offering awkward platitudes, the monks provided silent, unspoken support. Just as life seemed to regain balance, tragedy struck again. In mid-July, Hines came home from a bike ride with bruised, bleeding knees. That Friday, Pagels drove home grateful to have survived their ordeals. The next morning, Hines left early to hike Pyramid Peak. When he didn't return, police officers arrived. They'd found his body at the hospital. He was 49. Pagels focused on caring for Sarah and baby David. 3 days after Hines' death, she visited the monastery where Brother Theophane sat with her in silent prayer. Internally, she cried out, "So how do you feel about this?" She heard a voice saying, "This is fine with me. It's you I'm concerned about now." Angry, she responded, "Fine with you? You leave me here with 2 babies and it's fine with you?" She was completely surprised by this exchange that sounded like him but couldn't have come from her thoughts. Grief unleashed fierce anger in Pagels. Anthropologist Renato Rosaldo only understood the Ilongot tribe's headhunting practice after his wife's death triggered rage beyond endurance. His experience helped Pagels acknowledge her own fury. Biblical stories revealed stark contrasts. The Ilongot celebrate anger as natural and cleansing. Western culture treats it as shameful. The Book of Job weaves 2 traditions, an outer frame of unwavering faith and a poetic core where Job boldly curses his birth and demands God justify his suffering. The biblical narrative systematically redirects grief away from anger toward guilt, a pattern she recognized as harsh self-blame threatened to drown her legitimate rage. The Nag Hammadi texts offered alternative visions. Thunder, complete mind, personifies thunder as feminine power speaking in paradox. I am the first and the last, the one who is honored and scorned, the whore and the holy one. These ancient texts understood what we've forgotten. Suffering isn't punishment, but connection. Religion persists not because it provides answers, but because it offers imagination through dreams, art, poetry, music. Your losses don't require explanation. They require witnessing, ritual, community, and time.